Since very early on in the coronavirus pandemic, one of, if not the biggest question has been, when will we see a vaccine? Good news on that front finally emerged this week as Cambridge-based Moderna announced that phase one of its testing on a vaccine has delivered positive results. It's still very early in the process, but it is a start. So for more on what we know and what we don't about treating COVID-19, we're joined by Dr. Sandro Galea, Dean and Professor at BU School of Public Health. Dr. Galea, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Oh, it's great to have you back. And I want to start with that vaccine. Can you tell us what we can learn from these early phase one results? I know it was a small number of people they tested it on.
Yeah, I think you said it well when you said it's early. So there are three phases of vaccine testing before a vaccine can be used. Phase one is when you give it to a very small group of people to make sure that it's safe. Essentially, what just happened with this is phase one, eight people. We're dealing with only eight people, but they got the drug. It was shown to be safe. And just as importantly, it showed that antibodies developed in the people who received the vaccine. This vaccine is currently called mRNA-1273. And it showed that by taking the vaccine, you essentially replicate the antibodies you get by getting a natural infection, which of course then should make you immune. But we are a long way away. There are still phase two to go and phase three. And phase two, which the company is now heading towards, expands and gives the vaccine to people who have the properties of those who are at high risk, things like age and things like poor physical health. And if that is okay, then you need to move to phase three, where you give it to thousands of people to test for whether it works or not, and to make sure it's safe. So it's a good step. It's a good first step. I think you've seen the markets react positively, which is not unreasonable, but we're a long way away from a vaccine.
So phase three would be how many months out? I mean, what's the possible timeline here for when we might actually be giving vaccines to people?
Yes, I knew you were going to ask me that. Everybody wants to know. We're dealing with a year if things go according to plan, a year and a half. If they don't, that assumes that this phase one has worked, and then phase two works, and then phase three works. So it takes a while. You have to remember, if when you're getting to phase three, you have to enroll thousands of people. You have to give them the vaccine. You have to monitor them for safety. You have to make sure they develop antibodies, and all of that takes time. So we're looking at a year in an optimistic scenario.
So Dr. Galea, I want to talk about another medicine. We talked previously on the show about remdesivir, about it possibly having some positive results. We know there have been some results announced now from the federal government as well. What do we know about remdesivir at this point?
Yeah, so now we're dealing with something totally different. This is a treatment now for people who already have COVID-19. So remdesivir has been around for a while. It's been around for almost 10 years. It's a broad spectrum antiviral medication. This comes from Gilead, the drug company Gilead. And it has been tried against other type of RNA viruses. And this one, it has been tried early on this one. And the results initially were mixed. There was a study from China that showed that remdesivir did not do very much, but it was a small study. It had only about 180 patients. But the excitement right now is because a trial that was done with more than 1,000 patients in the United States, which was run by the NIH, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, found that remdesivir reduced time to recovery by more than 30% compared to people who did not take remdesivir. That, to be concrete, people who did not take remdesivir took 15 days to recover. Those with remdesivir took 11 days to recover. And that's very promising. And the way these studies are done is there is a group that monitors the results. And if the results are positive, then the group actually stops the study because it says we know enough for the study to move to the next phase. So that's very promising. This trial called the ACT trial suggests that remdesivir does work for people who have the disease, and it makes a difference. Now, we should be careful about what that means. We're dealing with 30% faster time to recovery. It still took median recovery time of 11 days. So we're not dealing with a miracle cure, but we are dealing with a drug that makes things better.
Okay, so now we've talked about a vaccine, we've talked about treatment. I do want to talk about prevention. And I have to ask you, Dr. Galea, about something the president said about the anti-malarial drug hydroxychloroquine. Yesterday, he surprised reporters when he announced that he's been taking it as a preventative medication for about a week and a half. Here's a little more of what he said.
And if it's not good, I'll tell you right, I'm not going to get hurt by it. It's been around for 40 years for malaria for lupus, for other things. I take it. Frontline workers take it. A lot of doctors take it. Excuse me. A lot of doctors take it. I take it. Now, I hope to not be able to take it soon because, you know, I hope they come up with some answer. But I think people should be allowed to.
So I want to get your reaction to that.
Well, the president's surprises are gifts that keep on giving. It's hard to know why the president is taking it. The data are pretty clear at this point on hydroxychloroquine that it really has no tangible benefits. There have been two studies that just came out in the British Medical Journal, one of the leading medical journals in the world, one from China and the other one from France, one an experimental study, one an observational study, and neither of them showed that hydroxychloroquine does what is being suggested it does. And more alarmingly, it's a drug with real side effects. It's both studies show that it causes what's called QT prolongation, which in other words is an abnormal heart rhythm, which can increase the risk of sudden cardiac arrest. So this is a drug with a challenging safety profile that does not really seem to have any benefit in the context of COVID-19. So I certainly would not advise any patient to take it.
And so his assertion that a lot of doctors and frontline workers are taking it, does that seem credible?
Well, I'm not sure that that's a database assertion.
Got it. So while we have you on the line, Dr. Galea, any reaction to Governor Baker's announcement of phase one of the reopening plan yesterday?
Yes, I think the governor and the state have announced a cautious reopening plan. That seems to me prudent and appropriate. There are phase one, phase two, phase three. When you look at the plan, it says that each phase might be 2 to 3 weeks, which will give people a sense of the path that we're on. It opens up carefully a few essential businesses, things like manufacturing and construction. But it's very clear in the document that it's doing that in the context of monitoring what's going on with the indicators in Massachusetts. But the bottom line is right now, the positive test rate has been down, so 64% since April 15th. Our number of COVID patients in hospital down almost 30%. Average COVID deaths down almost 40%, all in May. So the indicators are all trending in the right direction, which makes it very appropriate, to my mind, for the governor to announce a cautious reopening plan.
That's Dr. Sandra Galea, Dean and Professor of the BU School of Public Health. Dr. Galea, thanks for giving us your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you again.
Yesterday, Governor Baker laid out his four-part plan for gradually reopening the Massachusetts economy. Construction sites, factories, religious institutions, those are able to open immediately with new social distancing protocols. Then next week on Memorial Day, hair salons, car washes, dentist offices, and some others will be able to reopen. We want to talk today with three different business owners, two of whom are preparing for Memorial Day. A hair salon who can resume full service then with caveats. A dental practice that has already been able to operate for emergencies but can now expand the practice. And then a restaurant that is still closed for dining in with limited guidance about when that's going to change and how. So listeners, we want to hear from you on this. What businesses are you wanting to return to, likely to return to, hesitant to return to, especially in this first phase of reopening? And if you are a business owner, how are you reacting to what you heard from the governor yesterday? Call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So let's start with Alex Collins, who is the owner of The Orange Chair, a salon in Bedford. Alex, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So Alex, how does it feel to be able to reopen next week?
It feels good. We've, you know, been patiently waiting for some clarity on when we would be able to open. There's a lot of work that had to go into preparing to safely reopen.
Can you tell me a little bit about that work, Alex? What kinds of precautions are you taking? And what you were planning for, does it match what the governor is requiring now that you've received the guidance yesterday?
Yeah, everything does match pretty much. I've been following what other states have been requiring, so I've been preparing off of those. I figured our guidelines would be pretty similar, and they are. So luckily, my salon happened to be set up in a way that I didn't have to change too much. Our chairs are 6 feet apart. We're only going to have a limited number of stylists working at one time to really be able to maintain the social distancing for, you know, the first part of reopening. And there are a few other things that I'll have to work on. I need to put a barrier in between our hair sinks and a few other things that I'm still trying to figure out the best way to go about them.
Alex, what are you hearing from clients? Do you think lots of demand? Is everybody coming back? Or are people hesitant to come back? What do you think?
90% of people wanted our first available appointment. And then, you know, the other 10% definitely, you know, what they might fall into that high risk category that's being cautioned about going back out into the public so quickly. So, you know, people like that have been a little hesitant to book, and I completely understand, and I agree that they should also wait.
Listeners, what about you? Are you going to go back right away, get your hair cut? Are you going to get your dog groomed? Are you excited to go to the dentist? So, Alex, let me just put this out for listeners real quick. Let us know what you're going to do. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Alex, let's shift gears a little bit here. There has been some pushback to hair salons getting the green light while other industries are shuttered. Two things. One, okay, why this group in the first phase, Alex? And then the other question is, why in phase one, when there is so much personal contact in a salon? So there are some hairdressers who will not reopen yet for this reason. What made you decide to reopen on the first day it's available to do that?
Well, a lot of it had to do with the financial hit that I took. We've been closed for 10 weeks. You know, I wasn't prepared to close for 10 weeks. So I definitely need to get back and, you know, start generating revenue again. I think something we have working in our favor is hair salons should be a very sanitary place, regardless of what's happening now. A lot of this stuff is business as usual for us, in regards to sanitation and cleanliness. So I think that's a very positive thing that we have working in our favor right now.
Alex, we had a caller on our show yesterday, another small business owner, expressing real concern about how she is responsible for enforcement if, say, a customer comes in without a mask. So what about you? What if people show up in the salon without a mask or they don't keep their distance? How are you planning to handle that?
Well, you need to have a mask. You know, they're not my rules. It's the state's rules. And, you know, my business could be shut down if you don't comply with what they're asking. So, you know, we're just asking for everyone's cooperation. And if you, you know, if you don't want to cooperate or if you can't, you know, then maybe it's not a good time for you to come in and get your hair cut.
Let me ask you one more thing, Alex, and then we're going to add another voice to this. You sent out a reopening email to clients, and at the end of it, you actually set some guidelines around what you called COVID talk. You know, customers should leave private feelings regarding the pandemic at the door. What do you mean by that, and what made you decide to set that boundary in advance with your customers?
Well, I think we've all been heavily affected by this, and in so many different ways. And I've heard all different opinions on what's happening and, you know, how we should go about reopening and all different subjects. And I just, you know, we just want to get back to work. We want to see people. We miss all of our clients. And it's tough when you work in a public place because, you know, everyone feels differently about it and has been affected differently. And I know that it's been a really hard couple of months for a lot of people. And I just don't want any, you know, bad feelings like going back in between clients and stylists. So I just want to keep it light and, you know, just get back to what we should be doing.
All right. Thanks for that, Alex. Let's take a call here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To join this conversation, we have Tanya on the line from Dorchester. Hi there, Tanya.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks. How about you?
I'm good.
So jump right in, Tanya. What's on your mind?
So I was just answering the question about do we jump back or do we wait? I think that we've come really far. And, you know, I can even feel the antsy feeling inside of getting out. But I think that we've done a really good job with waiting. And I think I would wait. I would wait because, you know, now everybody's at that point where their hair needs to be done, the eyebrows need to be done, the nails need to be done, all those things need to be done. But we've come this far, So waiting a little bit more would be wise, whether we're at risk or not. We should wait. We definitely should wait.
Thanks for that call, Tanya. And Alex, I'm sure you hear both sides of this. What's your reaction to what Tanya's saying there?
I hear her. If it were up to me, I don't know that I would be going back on Monday. It's a really hard place to be in for business owners. If I don't reopen, I could potentially have to close my doors. I will lose clients to other salons that are open. We also run the risk of potentially getting infected or, having other people infected. It's a really hard spot to be in.
Well, one of the things that we are hearing is that the guidelines for keeping people safe in the salons and in the other kinds of businesses, these safety checklists, are well based in science and research, and one can hope that those will help keep lots of workers safe as things begin to reopen. I'd like to add another voice here. Alex, stay with us. I want to add now Dr. Ancy Verdier, the founder of Worcester Periodontics, which is a dental practice. On Monday, under the governor's plans, his office can reopen for high priority preventive services at doctor and dental offices. Dr. Verdier has been doing emergency services only so far. And again, listeners, we want you to join this conversation. 800-423-8255. Dr. Verdier, how are you?
Good, great. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you join us. What protocols do you have or will you have to have in place for the 25th? And do you feel ready for those?
I think as a dental office, we've been prepared. As you stated before, we were seeing emergencies as soon as the order was given to kind of close our doors. And I cannot tell you how many patients we've run into that have been so grateful for the services that we've been offering. Now, a lot of these folks have not been to the dentist for a long time or have not been able to get to their dentist. And so it was a very kind of strict criteria that we followed to treat these patients so they wouldn't end up in the emergency room. That was still our mission, was still to be the frontline healthcare worker to help the hospitals so that they didn't get overburdened and to flatten the curve. So as dentists across the Commonwealth, I think we've, and across the nation, we've always taken the precautions when it comes to infection control. And I think we're well poised to begin expanding our services because I can tell you that there's a lot of patients that are on the verge. We call it emergent services that we're offering come Monday. But there's a lot of patients that you can think about even a simple cavity turning into something bigger and more serious as to sepsis and also can cause death, which we don't want to see. But I think that dental appointments are so, oral health is such an important part of your overall health.
So let's grab a call here because there's a caller on the line who I think has a question that's relevant to both of you, actually. 1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. We've got Sungum in Waltham. Go ahead.
Hi, just a couple of things I have noticed. It may make sense now. People, when I go either buy a coffee or something, sometimes they have relationship with the clerk there or even with their hairdresser or a barber. They just like to have talk and laugh and giggle. The unfortunate thing about that is even after they get their order, they just stand there and chit-chat. Which is fine. Nothing against that. But given the situation that this conversation goes for a very long time, it makes people nervous because they're laughing and, talking
so
really loud.
Let me just ask you to put that in the form of a question for our guests. What's your question, Sungum?
Well, is there, we also need to bring this to the table, basically. People should start, talking less and less, get their things done, take your order and just leave.
That's a great point. Thanks for that call. I'm going to take that back to our guests to give them both a chance to react because both of you work in fields where there's a lot of close physical proximity with your patients or customers. What's your reaction to what he just had to say? Dr. Verdier,
on that. So what I'll tell you, listen, I think whether you're, you know, in the business of hair or you're working in somebody's mouth, it's still a relationship business, right? So I think that there's something that's lost when we're gowned up in masks and wearing, you know, PPEs, we call them. So there's some of that that is lost, right? And so now we had to make some accommodations. Before, we used to have patients that would sit in our waiting room and we would be able to go get them. Now we have them letting us know before they come in. We're taking their temperatures. We're doing all these different things where we're limiting the amount of traffic that comes through our offices, right? So there's something that's lost in that relationship. But I don't feel that, even though that we're treating the patients or treating our customers, that, you know, there has to be long, you don't, you know, we have to be more efficient with our time, but we could still do the right thing for people.
And actually, I have a caller for Alex in just a minute. But before I go to that, so Alex, please bear with me for a second. Doctor, higher standard for PPE at a dentist's office. Do you feel you're going to have access to the PPE you need to expand your client base starting next Monday? Dr.
Yeah,
Verdier?
Great question. I think that, you know, I think that's something that's been hounding not only community health centers and hospitals, but it also comes down to the dentist office too. Not every office is prepared. We're a periodontal office, so it's a surgical practice. So we've had those in place. And I think that our dental society has done a good job about helping members get the necessary PPEs in place and gearing us up so that we can see patients. I'm not saying that every dentist will have that available, but I think that, you know, closing down a majority of dental practices, right, and only leaving a couple of them open just to emergencies was setting us back, you know, quite a bit. So now that dentist office can start to treat patients, we're going to start slowly getting them back to the oral health that they need to be. They're not going to be exactly there, but I think that certain offices are going to be able to do that.
All right, great. Let's take one more call here. We've got Julie from Jamaica Plain. Julie, you go ahead.
Hi, I'm Julie from Jamaica Plain. I'm just calling in as a salon owner, concerned about not being able to follow the safety guidelines. As a hair cutter.
What concerns you, Julie?
I'm sorry?
What concerns you specifically?
The thing that concerns me about not being able to follow the safety guidelines and being in phase one is I'm not able to give a proper haircut wearing gloves, which are required in the safety guidelines. So that's probably my biggest concern, is not being able to follow that specific guideline along with blow dries. I know that blow dries are allowed, but in my salon, we are not going to be blow drying our clients, which it won't allow us to give the proper service, the proper quality of service, yet still needing to maintain the cost of our service in order to survive the industry.
So Julie, I want to take it back from you there. I'm really glad that you called, and I want to give Alex Collins a chance to react to that. Alex, please go ahead.
I get it. These are all thoughts that I had after reading through the guidelines yesterday. My salon, I decided we're not going to be offering blow dries until further notice. I think it was a tough decision to make. I sort of wish the state wasn't allowing blow dries. I don't think that it's safe to be circulating the air like that. You know, I think we're just going to have to do our best. It's going to be a new learning curve. It's going to be a new normal for us, and we're just going to have to do our best to give our best services and adjust. Other than that, there's not much else we can do.
All right. And that's Alex Collins, the owner of the Orange Chair in Bedford. Alex, I appreciate you being with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. Bye.
And Dr. Ancy Verdier, the founder of Worcester Periodontics, a dental practice in Worcester. I really appreciate you joining us too. And I wish you best of luck next week.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the time.
Thanks. And finally, let's turn to Bert Berard, the owner of Bert's Breakfast and Lunch in Uxbridge, who has got different news on Monday. Bert, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me.
So, Bert, were you disappointed that you didn't find out on Monday that you could, in this first round in phase one, open for in-restaurant dining?
Inside restaurant, I wasn't too upset about that. It was outdoor dining. I thought that he would let us do that because New Hampshire let it, Rhode Island let it, but governor didn't let us do the outdoor seating.
And what difference would it make to your business, Bert, if you could do that outdoor seating?
I think it would attract a lot more people. You know, when you eat breakfast, especially breakfast, is like you want to eat it right away when it's nice and warm. We give a package. It's all in to-go boxes. Sit on a picnic table, eat it, throw it in the trash, go on your way.
Now, the governor didn't provide any guidelines on what restaurants will have to do to reopen in Phase 2. And, of course, we're not sure yet when Phase 2 will be because each phase is a minimum of 3 weeks, kind of depending on how the public health environment looks during each phase. So how do you feel about the lack of guidance and the unknown around when you might be able to open for in-restaurant or at least outdoor seating dining?
I ain't too happy with it, you know. You got to prepare yourself for this stuff, you know. I was kind of prepared to be outdoor seating for today, but he said no. So it is giving me a little more time. I can find a little more guidelines. I do have a lot of guidelines in place ready to go. I'm working very closely with the Board of Health in my town, and they're helping me out. And I wasn't quite ready enough, so it's okay. But, you know, I wish you could give us some more guidelines, what we can and cannot do. He just didn't say anything.
Bert, you know, one of the things that we've heard when we've spoken with other restaurant owners is there is kind of a capacity to profit margin issue. There's a certain amount you have to be allowed to do in order to make it really financially worth doing it. Do you have concern that you're going to be able to operate either outdoor seating or indoor seating when it comes at a big enough number to make it make sense for your business?
I'm just making it by what I'm doing right now. I'm doing like 30% of my business right now. I'm just getting by. Thank you. We got a lot of family and friends that are helping me to get by this. I did close for 5 weeks, and I just reopened. I've been business for 17 years, so I am well established. A good percentage of my customers came back, so I'm just making it by. But I'm worried about come the wintertime when I only can have indoor seating. That's 3-4 months away, but that's when it's really going to make a big decision.
And, Bert, could you function if you continued to just do takeout? Can you make that work financially?
Yes, I could, because I do own my building. Like I said, I've been established for 17 years. It's not like I got high rents like a lot of the restaurants where they're renting their building. I own my building. I do have a rental property on the same property. So I'm in a fairly good position, but it's not that great.
Well, we'll be thinking about you, Bert, and I hope you'll have the go-ahead to open up with more seats in Phase 2 soon. That's Bert Berard, the owner of Bert's Breakfast and Lunch in Uxbridge. Thanks for being with us. Congregants around the Commonwealth can now return to their houses of worship as Massachusetts begins Phase 1 of its reopening. So we wanted to check in with local religious leaders to see how they're interpreting the new guidelines and what those guidelines mean, both for being in community, in a faith community, and for sacred practices. We have several voices to talk to, and we begin with Rabbi Joel Sissonwine, Senior Rabbi of Temple Beth Elohim in Wellesley. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Rabbi Joel.
Thank you. It's always good to think with you.
So, you know, I think there were a lot of people who were surprised that houses of worship were included in the Phase 1 reopening. Mm-hmm. Were you surprised, and are you happy, or are you concerned?
It's a great question. Look, just because the governor has enabled us to gather doesn't mean we should, or we will. We'll have our own community studying these issues. But I think that if anyone's going to lead, perhaps it should be a community that strives for the highest of ethical living. And so we'll explore, you know, these important questions of how to preserve life and be responsible at this critical moment in our nation's history.
Any rituals or parts of the service that are going to be hard to do in this new normal, Rabbi Joel, and how do you overcome those challenges?
Another great question, something we've been struggling with these past 10 weeks, and we've learned that you know, we are essential, but our building is not, that there are other ways to gather. I can say that the story of Judaism is the story of a people on a journey. And the key to a successful journey to the promised land, according to our tradition, is to make sure that everyone is okay, that we walk together, even the most vulnerable, the elderly, the frail, those with compromised immune systems. And so that's what we need to do. We need to walk together in this moment as a community and make sure no one's left behind.
You know, our WBUR colleague Miriam Wasser has reported on how COVID-19 has changed the ability to mourn in Jewish communities and noted to us the importance of a Jewish principle called, I'm not going to get this right, but I'm going to try, Pikuach Nefesh, which is a concept that the preservation of human life overrides any religious rule. Is that something that's coming into your mental framework as you're thinking about this moment?
Certainly. So the notion of Pikuach Nefesh is to preserve human life. That sometimes one needs to sacrifice a sacred obligation simply to be able to preserve life. So sometimes there are things that we want to do, we would like to do, but we really can't at this moment because we need to preserve human life, all human life.
And before we let you go, any message that you have to those who are deciding whether or not to return to services in their faith communities this weekend?
Yes, I think that even those who choose to return, and I hope that those institutions that do open are very, very careful about people's health, but even those who choose to return, it's not going to be the same. We can't hug. We can't touch. We need to maintain our social distance. So even a return to congregational life has to acknowledge that there's great loss and pain. And I just hope that our communities do it very carefully and are inclusive. Don't forget those who are vulnerable and make sure that they're a big part of our religious journey together.
That's Rabbi Joel Sissonwein, Senior Rabbi of Temple Beth Elohim in Wellesley. Thanks for coming back today. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
So let's turn now to Reverend Laura Everett, who's the Executive Director of the Massachusetts Council of Churches. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Reverend Laura.
Hi, Tiziana.
So the Mass Council of Churches met with Governor Baker's Reopening Advisory Board. Given that, what are your reactions to the plans as they've been released? And do the plans address any concerns that you may have presented when you met with them?
Well, the plans raise a lot of questions. I know pastors in my network are feeling overwhelmed in a lot of situations. Some are pleased that they have the option to gather. And every pastor I know wants their church to be a place of healing, not a source of sickness. And there are some very real practical concerns that we just don't have answers to at this point. Do we have the cleaning supplies? Do we have masks? How do we do this?
Well, let's stay on that one for a second because, you know, you are a representative or part of a very large community of churches. Yeah. What is the likelihood that these faith institutions are going to be able to get a hold of the physical protective equipment, sanitizing equipment, et cetera? I mean, there's a spiritual dimension to this, but there's also a very important practical dimension.
That's right. And I think pastors are working with their denominational leadership, and we're going to see a really wide range in the weeks and months ahead. We already are seeing that. We're seeing some churches that say we are preparing to meet on Sunday. And we are seeing, for example, the Episcopal Diocese of Massachusetts are saying not until July 1st. We have other churches in the United Church of Christ that are saying not until the end of the summer, and still others are saying not until May 2021 or until a vaccine is found. There is a really, really wide range that we're seeing.
What is lost when a congregation can't physically be together to worship?
Oh, so much has been lost. I've been amazed and impressed by the creativity of all of our pastors in this time who have found wonderful ways to connect. But the truth is, we believe in a God who became embodied in Jesus Christ. And so being present in body matters to Christians in the rituals of baptism and Eucharist, to holding hands and singing. And things like singing are potentially very problematic. And so we're seeing congregations have to adapt.
You know, one of the other questions that's been on my mind is the question of First Amendment freedoms, church and state, balancing public health with those freedoms. You know, especially given what we saw with the Worcester pastor, Reverend Christopher Casey, who continued holding in-person services amid the state's stay-at-home advisory. How are you thinking about that balance?
I think it's a very delicate balance, and certainly one that is in the mind of every elected official. Look, that to continue to hold service when our elected and public health officials are saying we are required to stay at home, that's not a risk I would have taken. And Christians make this really countercultural claim that we are all part of one church. And I know that there are people in the church that do things I find infuriating, and I'm sure that I do things that other Christians find objectionable. But my job is to call us back to those core Christian values we see in Jesus, who's always healing and always looking for those who have been hurt.
I want to ask you, what is your message to people who are trying to decide for themselves whether or not now is the time to return to the buildings, to their houses of worship, regardless of their faith tradition?
Well, since the rabbi included some Hebrew, I want to turn to the Greek and to remind folks that the word economy comes from the Greek oikonomia, which means the whole household of God. And as we're thinking about taking care of the whole economy, the whole household of God, we want to make sure that we are prioritizing the communities that have been most harmed, Black, immigrant, unhoused communities, and that we expect that of the churches, and we expect that of our elected leadership too.
That's Reverend Laura Everett, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Council of Churches. Thanks for being with us today. I really appreciate it. It was good to talk to you again.
Thank you, Tiziana.
So let's turn now to Father John Ooney, pastor at St. Cecilia Parish in the Back Bay. Welcome to Radio Boston, Father John.
Hey, Tiziana. Nice to be with you.
It's good to talk to you. What does reopening mean for your parish, Father John?
Well, we've been, zooming away, trying to see what the governor was going to say today and trying to balance that with what the archdiocese was thinking and all of that in the mix of what's the common sensical thing to do here. You know, we draw in some numbers. So even with a 40% occupancy, that still puts probably like 240 to 50 people in. And, you know, it's logistical questions. How do we do that? Like the Reverend Laura was saying, is there enough sanitizer? How do we do that? How do we space people out? Who gets in? Who does it? Like, it just doesn't feel natural.
How do you do that? What are you going to do?
We're not sure yet. We're talking about it. One thing we feel is no pressure to rush. Like just because we get the quote-unquote go-ahead, that doesn't mean we're going to do it. I think the governor's and his team have been very thoughtful. It's like a two-edged sword because we start too early and it's a disaster. Start too late, churches go down, like businesses go down and restaurants go down. When is the right time? What's just the right mix? So we really have just begun talking about that. Well, we've been talking about it, but now that we've got kind of this phase one opening, we're not sure exactly when, but I could tell you it won't be this Sunday.
So it's not going to be right away for you?
No.
Are your parishioners a part of this conversation? Are they helping you sort through this?
Great question. Well, up to this point, it's been our staff discussion, the team, because things are kind of fresh from yesterday. But even prior, as we've been thinking about it, you get input here and there. But our parish council is going to be meeting tomorrow evening, and then parishioners, and we do things. We're not overly autocratic around here, so the message gets out and the input comes in, and I think we'll all be involved, but it can't be it's not going to be a kind of the whole parish committee decides this. You know, we're just going to try to do the right thing, again, in smart, responsible ways, in sync with like the governor's timeline, the mayor's, the diocese, and just what seems to be right for us here. So I know that sounds,
you know,
vague.
We recognize. No, I mean, it sounds real. It sounds like you're still sorting it out.
Yeah.
We recognize that there's both a community need here and then there are sacred practices. I know, you know, I'm Catholic and I keep thinking about communion. I mean, that's a sacrament. It's not mass unless there's communion. So for your church, for your faith tradition, how do you think about that? And how should any faith tradition that has sacred practices that run up against these public health concerns begin to navigate that?
Thoughtfully, I'd even say prayerfully, like for all of our faith backgrounds, just we're all kind of dealing, you know, not to oversimplify, but the Jews, the Muslims, and the Christians, we all believe in the same God. You know, we have the different names, but we all believe in the same God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the God of Abraham, I mean. And, you know, this God is... A God that wants to be in the thick and thin of our lives. And as we, as we go forward in our different traditions, things are different. But as the rabbi said, you know, the human good outweighs any religious rule. And that's a very broad paraphrase of what he said so eloquently, you know. So we have to think of these things. So, for instance, we're going online with our masses, and we've had really significant bump in viewership, and I don't know what that says about Catholic culture. You know, like, it's easy to have the bacon and eggs frying in the background, and, you know, some blueberry muffins, and have a cup of coffee, and then just watch, and then, you know, you can kind of tune in, tune out. That's a different experience than, you know, actually coming here and being part of it, and receiving communion and communing with the good God, with each other. Those are two different experiences. You know, there's a tactile nature to this, so it's. It's different. I think the Pope said, like, we're in a tunnel, you know, so this isn't like the new way, the Jetsons. You know what I mean? This is how the new worship's going to be. The desire is to come back and to bring everybody back into the fold, but we have to do it in really sensible ways. I'll tell you just a personal anecdote, if I can. My mom just died, you know, and it's like we don't have the normal comforting rituals, you know, of the wake and the gathering and the hugging and the kissing and the telling stories and the laughing and the crying. We don't have the time together. We don't have the liturgy, that mass. And then, you know, so we're at the cemetery with a small group of, you know, 10 people. And so all of these things missing don't provide, the same experience, via the internet than they would if they were in person. So, and that goes to all the different religious traditions, right? We're mourning in different ways. We're celebrating in different ways. These are strange times, you know, but we can't lose touch with the source of what gives us hope and helps us to carry on and propels us to keep loving each other. I don't mean to give a homily.
Well, thank you
there,
for sharing. No, that's all right. Jeez. Pastors do that. I appreciate you sharing that, and I'm sorry for your loss, and I do appreciate you joining us today. That's Father John Uni, pastor at St. Cecilia Parish in the Back Bay. Thank you.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So let's turn now to Sheikh Yasser Fahmy, instructor on Muslim studies at Harvard Divinity School. Welcome back to Radio Boston. It's good to talk to you.
Good to be back with you.
So what does this reopening permission, for lack of a better word, mean for you and those you serve?
Well, I think, first I want to give my condolences to Father Uni. You know, I would love to have been there with him in his time of need. And I think Father Uni also, he captured the complexity. You know, we are in unprecedented times, and everyone's trying to kind of make sense of what's going on. And he mentioned that in many ways, you know, the governor's, you know, maintaining a very delicate balance of trying to, you know, open up the doors for people to negotiate their spiritual realities and congregational realities at the same time, the deep concern for public health and welfare. So it definitely is not easy. And you know, I think everyone is thoughtful and cautious. And, you know, the Muslim community is a community that really does put as a primary concern the health and the wellness of the collective, the community and the collective. And you know, one of the beautiful things that I've seen in this time period, as we've kind of like altered our styles of congregating and coming together and praying and worshiping, is when we've we've kind of changed our sacred practices in some ways. You know, obviously our hearts are attached to the mosque and we want to go back to Friday prayers. It's just so unprecedented that we haven't been able to go to Friday prayers. We're in the sacred month of Ramadan. You know, we are so attached to the mosque in Ramadan. Every night we're going to the mosque for prayer.
Yes. What does it mean for the end of Ramadan?
Yeah, I mean, and I mean, Eid is a huge thing. I mean, Eid is our big celebration of the year, you know, and it's in a few days, and just to not have people around and to not be celebrating, everyone getting dressed up, food, gifts, toys, laughs, laughter, everything. I mean, that's a huge part of it, and that will be missed. I mean, I mean, as Father Uni and others have said, I don't see that we're going to be rushing into anything just because. We're seriously cautious about this and thoughtful. The Muslim Task Force is a Muslim task force. It's a national entity that's been put together on COVID that I shared with the producers. They put out a statement on what a phased opening perhaps may look like. Very, very, very thoughtful, very conservative in its nature. But the one thing I did want to share, which I think is integral to appreciate, is, you know, we're all here and we're all trying to figure out our spirituality, our connection to God, our connection to community. And one of the really beautiful transitions that I've really been so happy seeing is how in the Muslim community, you know, in the absence of going to the mosque and being amongst, we've really brought the mosque out into the world around us, into the streets. And so you see the tremendous humanitarian efforts and relief efforts and efforts to bring food and all sorts of, you know, protective care packages. You see all the work of like an organization like ICNA Relief locally in Boston, which is doing tremendous work to resolve these matters. And so you see the communities coming together. So much food is being passed around. And you see a sense of togetherness and a coming together in this time of need that in many ways perhaps wasn't at the same level before. And that's a really beautiful thing. And so, you know, I encourage my, you know, everyone from all faith traditions to imagine what it looks like to bring your congregation out into the public sphere, into your community, you know, through Zoom and through streams, but also, you know, what does it mean to really be there for others in this time and to give? And I'm really inspired by the examples that I've seen. You know,
that's Sheikh Yasser. Oh, I'm sorry, Sheikh. I have to end you there. We've only got 30 seconds left. Sheikh Yasser Fahmy, instructor on Muslim studies at Harvard Divinity School. Thanks for being with us.
No, my pleasure. No problem. Thank you so much.